session number 17365, reel 5.
Mr. Warrington, reel 5.
So I realised that I wasn't going to say anything, any name, rank and number, so I went back to my room. By this time, I'd been shot down on Thursday, Friday in Berlin. This was Saturday. I went back into this room. It got dark at 5 o'clock. There were no lights. Of course, you were just in the dark by yourself, lying on these bedboards. If you wanted to go and spend a penny, there was a handle near the door, and you pulled this handle down, and it shot a kind of signal outside. And they kept you waiting for ages till you were absolutely busting and busting, and you couldn't do anything at all about it. You were too proud to pee in the room. Eventually they came, and of course no sooner had you got back again than you wanted to go again. That was your nerves working. Anyway, next morning was Sunday, and about the middle of the morning I was taken out and taken out of this building and into another building and into an office where there were two Luftwaffe officers. I sat down. They were perfectly polite. It was their job to interrogate me. They wanted to know who the squadron commander was, what the squadron was, what bombs were carrying, all that sort of thing. So, I mean, I kept on saying that, I'm sorry, name, rank and number is all I'm allowed to say. And then he would start yawning about something, about the war. He was trying to loosen you up, get you to talk. He even showed me some photographs of a warehouse with hundreds of bodies in it. Said his wife was in Berlin, and how worried he was. I mean, I was quite pleased to see all these bodies, naturally. I must have been there for perhaps nearly an hour, I would think. And I never said anything about anything. It did. You see, these fellows, they had, I think, their job was to find out that you were genuine. Because he once said to me, that I've got to know these things because I've got to establish you are who you say you are. So I said, well, I've got this identity disc on me. And which I realised when I said it was a bit stupid. And they said, I mean, you might be a spy for all I know. And they said, you might know what happens to spies in Germany. Well, I didn't, but I could guess that it wasn't very pleasant. So it was trying to sort of frighten you a little bit, really. But he also mentioned Oakington in passing. He must have got some idea. You see, there's maybe 40 fellows get shot down, and they're interviewing them, and somebody lets something slip. Your plane's there, perhaps, if it isn't burnt out, it's maybe got its squadron letters on. They would know what the squadron letters meant. And so they have to try and establish who you are because they don't want loose people wandering about in Germany. They have to, as I say, establish who you are. So, I mean, he'd got a job on as well. And they both tried the best to get me to talk, which I didn't talk about anything at all, really. Then I went back to this room. It'll be about midday then, 1 o'clock. Then I think I faced then, not knowing how long, what was going to happen next, the longest week of my life, I think, because nothing happened for a whole bloody week. I was in this room. Only time I went out was to pee. You never got washed. You never got shaved. You never took your clothes off. It was dark from 5 o'clock till 8 o'clock. You're absolutely thrown back to yourself. It's a wonderful experience, really, looking back on it, because you're really thrown back into your own mind. I mean, I've always been a churchgoer, and God, I used to pray then, and it really helped me. It really did help me, because I don't know why, but it did help me. you're thinking about your past life, about all the fun you've had. You're going over each day, thinking about girls that you've been with, everything. I even counted the nails in the floorboards one day, I think. I did find there was a slight... There was a window here, but it was this rippled glass. You couldn't see through it. But I did notice there was a tiny... When they'd been putting it in, there was a tiny bit that had come out of one corner. So by standing on the end of the bed, I could look up and I could look through this window, but all I could see was the building opposite. It was nothing at all. At night, you could hear the Hundführer going round with his dog. You could hear it panting. There was no chance of escaping at all. You got very, very, very little to eat. A bowl of soup for lunch, two slices of bread for breakfast, two slices of bread for tea, and that was it. Dark, 5 o'clock. Really had to draw on your reserves then. So I did find that I could talk to the fellow in the next cell by banging on the wall. But I didn't know he was a plant, and he didn't know if I was. So apart from... I don't know what we said. We only ever spoke once. When we heard the man in the corridor, you could hear this man going up and down the corridor all the time, the slow plunk, plunk of these steps. Especially when you pulled the thing down and you would hear him come in and think, ah, good, and he would go splunk, 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 and away to the other end, and you have to wait till he came back again. After a whole week, I went back into this room again with this one man. He was quite a nice fellow, really. He said he'd been on ops in Russia. So I started the whole thing again, you see, and... We didn't get anywhere. We didn't get anywhere at all. I tried to demoralise you by eating a big piece of chocolate cake, smoking a fag, picture post lying on the desk, you know, but we knew all about this. We knew. I mean, they told us that if this fella suddenly says to you, isn't it your little boy's birthday next week, or isn't it your wedding anniversary in a month's time? Don't be surprised at all, because they get the German paper, the English papers, and they list, they keep records. I don't know whether it was this time, or the last time, or the next time, I mean, but he did catch me out. They're obviously practiced, these fellas. And he started on, said, how's your friend Billy Talbot, by the way? Well, I'd been best man at Billy Talbot's wedding in Leeds the year before. But this didn't take me by surprise, because the photograph had been on the front page of the Yorkshire Post. I said, oh, he's fine, but I haven't seen him for a long time. And he said, was it a good wedding, plenty to drink, plenty of girls, and, you know, you've relaxed. And he said, was that while you were at Oakington? Just like that. Well, no matter what I said, I think he would have known I was at Oakington. If I'd said, where's Oakington? Or what I could have said. I mean, I think before I knew what I was saying, I said, oh no, it was a long time ago. That's what I said. Just like that. I'd relaxed, you see. So he would know that I was from Oakington. What, how that's going to help them win the war, I don't really know. But that's the kind of thing you had to be aware of, you see. So anyway, I didn't get anywhere, so I went back again into the same old thing, in this thing, you know. But at this time, you were thinking about food. The saliva was running down your mouth as you thought about it. And you just didn't know what was going to happen to you. Tuesday, I went back in again, and the same fellow's there. And I said to him, I'm getting a bit sick of this, actually. What do you want to know? I said to him, you're along, when you're on your own and there's nobody to talk to, you become terribly garrulous. You can't help yourself talking. And he said, well, he wanted to know where I was trained, and he wanted to know this, that, and the other. Well, I thought, well, I mean, I was trained 4 years, 5 years before. We're not going to lose the war, I don't think. I said, well, if I tell you these things that you want to know, will you let me out? That's what I said to him. See, we were quite pally, really. And he said, yes. So I told him where I was trained. Mr. Churchill, I'm sorry. And then he started asking more, and he said to me, I don't want to know about your G and your H2S. We know all about those. Well, that shook me as much as anything, really, because, I mean, these radar things, you know. But, I mean, I suppose they're bound to know all about it, all the planes that have crashed out, all the men they've interviewed, and that sort of thing. So he didn't really ask me very much, apart from what I was trying. He did ask me what height we were flying at when we bombed. Well, I mean, I did tell him that, because I thought, well, the bloody gunners would know what height we were at, wouldn't they, in any case. So, in the end, that was it. So I went, it was lunchtime again, and I walked back. There must have been two of them there, because they both came with me. We walked out up a pathway, we got to the end, they turned to the right to the officer's mess, and I turned to the left to the prison cells. And I said to them, I'll get you two after the war. I said to them, could have shot me on the spot, couldn't they? But it was that sort of a situation. So, right, when I got back in the room, there was not long before we got some books came in. The lights came on at 5 o'clock, and during the evening I was taken out and I was put in another quite big room with about another 10 Kriegers.
Kriegsgefangene.
Correct. The chatter was just like that thing in Berlin. Everybody's jabbering away at the tops of the voices. And the next day we went into Frankfurt into a sort of transit camp. I was only there for about 4 days, but whilst I was there, Baird Smith walked in one day. He didn't know anything about the others. One thing I missed. When we were in this hospital, I told you about Arthur Jones, how he came to join me later. It was him that told me about Bartholomew. Bartholomew had got a damaged neck, and he told the others in this hospital that when he'd been in the police station, he'd been clubbed on the side of the head with a rifle butt. That was the same police station as I had been in.
Was he the one whom you said died?
So he died whilst Jones was there. He only lived a short time. So, I mean, they must have broken his neck. I suppose, poor old Bartholomew. That's right. Now, we learnt later that Baird Smith and I were the only two survivors. Bartholomew and Andrews are buried in Berlin. Baird Smith's been to the grave, put flowers on it. The other three have no known grave, and their names are inscribed at Runnymede. That's Ridley, Johnston, and Brown stroke Smith. So, I mean, you know, you can imagine that these planes getting crashed down, then it all sets on fire. The Germans have got thousands of their own to be looking after, never mind digging them out for bodies, are they? They aren't going to bother, really, just scoop the whole lot into a pit, I think. So, after a few days there, we were put on a train, and for about a 3-day journey on very, very hard seats, not cattle trucks. We went to Sagan. It was quite an eventful journey, really, because we were going all through Bavaria. It was a very nice country, of course. Kept stopping at stations. We were never allowed out. We did stop at one big station once at night. And there was one fella told a story. We were all allowed to go into the lav and have a pee. And one fella said that there was a German standing next to him, or a man standing next to him. He said out of the side of his mouth, "Keep it up, lads." He told us this, whether this was true or what, I don't know who the man was. So then we got to Stalag III. Well, you don't really want to know all about that. You must have heard about that before.
Well, I don't think the general treatment in Stalag III, about which I've recorded a great deal,
yes.
Any outstanding things that happened to you personally, any incidents that happened to you?
Well, it was February by this time, and it was just 6 weeks before the Great Escape. Now, you know all about the Great Escape, don't you?
I've interviewed one or two people who survived it.
Paul Brickhill wrote the book, The Great Escape, and Paul Brickhill lived in the same hut as I did. I knew him quite well. I well remember the day that they decided they were going out, because we were out on the parade ground on a pell, as it was called, being called. We were counted twice a day, and it was the afternoon call. And I remember as this German went down the road counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I thought, the next time you count us, mate, you're going to have a shock, because I knew that they were going out that night. What happened then? The first thing, well, we knew they were going out and things, but there was an air raid which upset them, really, because all the lights went out, including in the tunnel, which must have been absolutely horrible. The thing that woke us up was about 4 or 5 in the morning, perhaps, when there was a shot. We heard a shot. And this was, in fact, when they stopped. So that's really all I can say about that. I do remember them auctioning off the clothing of those people who were shot. Because clothing, it was extremely short. And things would sell at most ridiculous prices. I mean, nobody had any money. They just used to make a cheque out to be cashed at the end of the war. So, I mean, a thing like a silk scarf might sell for £25 or something. Quite ridiculous, like this. They sold all that stuff off, and eventually one other thing I remember. We did have a memorial service out in the open, and the Germans were very wary as to what might happen, so they all came. A lot of them came in with machine guns and put the machine guns all around us. We were also told by our own people to cut a diamond off the bottom of our black ties and sew it on our arm, which we did, on your greatcoat. I had that on, we all had them on for the rest of the war. Just to remind them that we wouldn't forget this shooting.
Can you tell me anything about Paul Brickhill?
He was an Australian, and I was sent some newspaper cuttings a while ago about him. I have a friend in Australia called Fletcher, who was in our room. And he emigrated to Australia after the war, and he sent me this paper, and there was an article about Paul Brickhill, who'd made a lot of money, and I think it had slightly gone to his head, according to this newspaper article, and he was quite a lonely old man now, living in Australia. I think there was a photograph of him.
But any memories of him in Sagan?
Nothing particular. No, he was just another fella. He was just another fella, really. When you... I mean, we knew he was writing something, but I mean, I said to him, if you're writing a book, will you mention me in it? Which he didn't. No, No, not really. No. There were a surprising number of people who were known after the war were in Sagan. I mean, Anthony Barber, Chancellor of the Exchequer, was one. The man who played Maigret, Rupert Davis, used to perform on the stage. There's a man called Butterworth who used to be on the television. There was John Casson, who was the son of Sybil Thorndike. All these people used to appear on the stage there.
How did you come to be liberated?
Well, it was the next year, of course. I mean, I was there in Sagan until about January 1945, when the Russians were coming, so they decided they'd have to move us. So one Saturday night at about 7 o'clock, they said, "You're all going to march in an hour's time." And this didn't surprise us, because we knew the Russians were coming. We could even hear the guns. And, of course, we had used to get the BBC News every day through this hidden radio, which I think was kept in a gramophone. Nobody ever told you where it was. So we all set off and did this awful march. When I say awful, it wasn't awful in like the sergeants had the run down the road when they were chased with bayonets and set on with dogs. It was nothing like that. It was just the weather that was bitterly, bitterly, bitterly cold, minus 20, 30 degrees centigrade. After that march, which I'm hurrying over really, it lasted about a week or a fortnight or something, and we ended up the last two or three days in these cattle trucks. 40 on HVO, it says on the outside. And I mean, you got pushed into these cattle trucks, and of course there was nothing. People had blankets, they made hammocks and got up in the roof, in the ceiling, which was good. I mean, you could just sit on, I'm sure it had square wheels, this truck of ours. But somehow you slept, you were carrying everything you'd got, you were carrying. It would stop now and then, and that people would get out and have a pee. It stopped in a siding in Hanover, and we very foolishly, you see, they gave us no water or no food. We got some water from an engine driver, which was just oily, filthy water. And it made us terribly ill. I mean, when we finally got where we were going, the sickness and diarrhea was dreadful. We went to a place called Milag Nord, which was a camp which had housed mercantile marine people, civilians. And when they'd left, they'd stripped it, you know, of everything, of any use at all. So it was just a bundle of huts. It was, of course, February. Fortunately, it wasn't all that cold. But we then had the really toughest time that I'd had, by any means. But it was nothing, really, to compare to what some people had, like the Japanese prisoners, or even the sergeants, on these terrible marches. But it was bad enough for me. It was just filthy and filth and crowded and not much food and all this. It was very, very much like England. The hawthorn hedges and flat green countryside. It was about perhaps 40 miles west of Bremen, I would think. We'd see the air raids going over, bombing Bremen, see the planes being shot down. We even saw the V2s being launched. These things, we didn't know what they were, just this great roaring noise. Just like a tornado going over, and this light went right up into the sky. And that's what they were. We didn't know at the time. Oh, I must have done, really, when I think about it, because we would have got the BBC News. People very, very quickly got organised in these prison camps. They were terribly skillful. People couldn't make things. You know, there would, we'd all this tinned food, of course, and, of course, this, they would get the solder off it. They would melt it off with candles and make it into something else. They would even make it into retorts to make spirits. Fletcher, who was quite clever at this sort of thing, he made us what he called a smokeless cooker. It wasn't smokeless at all, but it was very effective through boiling things using very, very little fuel. The fuel being chips of wood or bits of cardboard that you found lying about. And it was just two Klimtins. A Klimtin's a tin about 5 or 6 inches across. It had powdered milk in, and one was fitted on top of the, maybe three, one on top of the other. There's a hole at the bottom, and you burnt the stuff in the bottom, these bits of chippings of wood that you found, of cardboard. And at the top, you put in your tin, which was slightly smaller than the Klimtin. It had two pieces protruding from the side, so it sat on the top. And you lit the thing, and all the heat, of course, was going in contained in this cylinder. And it boiled things very quickly. This was for, you know, cooking vegetables or making a cup of tea, because you didn't have much coal or ordinary fuel. So it was worth the experience, really. It was the whole thing. It was really, you know, it didn't do you any harm, as long as you had the right outlook. I mean, some fellas would say, well, the bloody hell should it happen to me, and, you know, and they'd lie on the beds all day long. Well, I mean, really, you'd got to get up and do something. I mean, I started, there were classes for everything. You could learn Japanese, you could take your matric. This was at Sagan. It took much longer to get organised, the Malag Milag. But, I mean, there was orchestras, people had instruments, there was the theatre. I was taking lessons from the padre in method to become a member of the Methodist Church. They don't call it confirmation, but it's a similar thing to the Anglican's confirmation. I was taking lessons from him. I used to go to service on a Sunday. But also, there was a wonderful system called Food Akko. Food Akko. Akko being an Egyptian word for, or is not a derivation, an alteration of Egyptian word, akkas as money in Egypt, and this was called food akko. And you when there was plenty of food, if you wanted to swap some food, you could put it in to food akko, and they would sell it. The currency was points. There's a banking system whereby, say I sold something and I got 75 points for it. The banking system would register that I was 75 points in credit. If I wanted to buy something, maybe I wanted to buy some tobacco, I could go along and bid at the auction and say I spent 50 thing, they would, my thing would be reduced by 25, and the 50 would go into somebody else's account. And this was all run by, I forget the fellow's name now. I was on the staff of this thing. It operated for a very, very long time. And it was a very good pointer.